Welcome to the Tech Humanist Show, a multimedia format program exploring how data and technology shape the human experience. I'm your host, Kate O'Neill.
It's not just somebody who makes plastics or oil and gas or steel manufacturing or chemical plants. It's the internet that needs a lot of water.
That's Amy Killeen. She's the president of the Water Environment Federation, WEF, and the COO of Providence Engineering and Environmental Group, a regional firm based in the Southeast United States.
So what are we doing collectively in the water space to say, hey, look, we all have similar problems. What can we do to innovate together, more so than just in our own little groups, to figure out some of the common solutions to some of these challenges?
In this episode, we're looking at the intersection of technology, particularly AI, and water security. We'll delve into how technology can help address the challenges of water scarcity and what the future holds for water management. But first, back to Amy. You majored in environmental science at LSU, right? And you work in the Gulf Coast region.
I sure do.
Yeah. So it's part of my philosophy of strategic optimism and just my work in general. I believe that our connections to place shape how we envision bright futures for communities around the world. So I wonder, how have your experiences in the places you've lived and the communities you've worked in shaped your dedication to creating a future where clean air and water are accessible to everyone?
Yeah, so absolutely. My story is rooted in water along the Gulf Coast. I grew up going and spending vacation time along the Gulf of Mexico with my family in South Louisiana. Due south of New Orleans, there's beaches. We enjoy going to them. But it is also where, as a child and even now as an adult, a majority of my food comes from that water. Crabs, fish, shrimp, oysters, the majority of what I ate growing up and still again today is from those waters, the stuff my family and friends and people on the island that we have a place at, they catch it. So growing up in that community, in that culture of catching your food and bringing it in, made me keenly aware when there were rusty oil barrels on the beach or dead fish that, hey, look, you know, something's not right here. Or we wore tennis shoes as children because you may get oil tar balls on your feet. And then, you know, your mom and dad had to rub them off. So, you know, I grew up wanting to change that and make that better and be able to go places where I could. And it's funny, people, I always write, I love being barefoot, right? And it's because those memories I have as a child of like having to wear shoes on the beach, that like, no, I want to be able to go places where I know other water people are working and keeping the water clean so I can be barefoot in their water too. Just like, yeah, I feel like we've come so long, so far, to clean the Gulf of Mexico, where now I can actually go barefoot on the beach and not have to worry about getting tar balls on my feet.
That's wonderful. That really adds color and context to that line in your bio. You shared an infographic on X, I guess we're calling it, from WEF that states that over 2 million Americans live without basic access to safe drinking water and sanitation. So can we start with talking about why that is? Like, in a perfect world, what would basic access and safe drinking water and sanitation look like?
So, I mean, right now it comes down to funding, right? And we've seen with the bipartisan infrastructure bill, a lot of focus on water. In the billions of dollars, but it is absolutely not enough to help extend clean water and sanitation to those people who do not have it. Traditionally, that's going to be in marginalized communities. It's going to be our Native American and Black communities that have less access. I think I read a statistic when I was preparing for a talk the other day, it's in the 90% of, you know, your... What determines whether you have access to clean water and sanitation is the color of your skin. I can go find that quote because I used it. But again, so that's a problem. And that is something that we as an organization, we know it exists and we're working to help resolve some of those issues. Number one, nobody even knows we exist really in the world. They just think water comes out the tap. It's always clean everywhere around the world in every home in the U.S. And that when they flush the toilet, It's going to go somewhere, be taken care of. And so most of the public just doesn't even know our sector, water, wastewater, and stormwater is even out there as such a great opportunity, a great job opportunity. It's like so recession proof, right? Like you will always need clean water and sanitation and to manage stormwater, no matter what's going on in the economy. So, you know, we're seeing the need for even baby steps here. We can't get funding to serve these communities if nobody even knows we exist to start with. So the communications, the making ourselves known to the public, we've always been a sector that is out of sight. If we're not in the news, that's good news, right? Out of sight, out of mind. All of our pipes are buried. And I like to say water, unlike a pothole, water usually doesn't speak for itself. You know, you drive over a pothole every single day, but the water and wastewater just flows sight unseen until it's upset and has a problem, right? So until a water line breaks, until a sewer line or a sewer manhole is overflowing, like, or until we have flooding within our homes, you know, water usually only talks to you when it's something bad or it's not a good situation. And so it's incumbent upon us in the water sector to tell you the good story of water, the other, you know, 364 days of the year, that we're out there, we're doing things, we're taking care of our rivers and lakes, we're making sure you have clean drinking water, we're making sure your stormwater is getting to where it should go and not backing up into your homes. So again, you know, we've recognized this is certainly an issue within the United States and what we as a sector, you know, can start to do to make ourselves known that we exist out here and to buy that public support that then turns into, you know, legislative funding to the tune. We just love to get what transportation gets, right? Like we need to go out there and make people understand, make our congressmen and women understand like what the need is in our communities for water and wastewater infrastructure and stormwater infrastructure as well. So again, it starts with funding. And a lot of these underserved communities are definitely in very rural areas where, you know, does it make sense to provide community water or sewer? Well, it may not, but how can we cost effectively provide them, you know, water and sewer for their individual homes or residences that makes sense? One of the other struggles we have as engineers and scientists is we like to engineer our way out of things. And it may not always be an engineering problem, right? So recognizing when it may be like a policy issue or a regulatory issue, and we need to talk to different people about having policies changed within local or state or federal government and starting those conversations. So I know that's a long, very convoluted answer, but
it's perfect. You know, a lot of what you talked about sound like water challenges. And I know the Water Environment Federation's vision for the future is a life free of water challenges.
Yep.
Can you talk about what, and you sort of did, but what the biggest water challenges we're facing right now are and what the space between those challenges and a water secure future looks like?
So again, like you said, you know, not only in the US do we have almost 2 million people without clean water and sewer service to their home, there's community systems that are on the brink of similar things to Flint, Michigan, Jackson, Mississippi, that we need to get money to. Again, the bipartisan infrastructure bill gave a lot of money. And like what we're seeing here in Louisiana is a lot of the small towns, the person who runs your water or wastewater treatment plant is also the dog catcher sometimes. And they're cutting, like they're doing so many things that they don't have time to go apply for the grant and the funding necessary. So even if we say, and we dedicate money to communities, small communities or underrepresented communities, they just don't have the bandwidth even or the capacity sometimes to go out and apply to get the money we're trying to give them. So it's making that connection between, okay, look, we have the money, and then who are the communities that need it most? And what are the mechanisms that the federal government can put in place to ensure we're helping them overcome some of the issues with just simply filling out an application to apply for a grant? They don't have grant writers in a lot of these small communities. They don't have, you know, they may have an engineer that's just a consultant. They don't have them on staff, right? So providing the tools necessary to help bring up a lot of these smaller communities and smaller utility systems so that, you know, they don't turn into, well, we just didn't have the money to fix, you know, a leaking pipe. And now all of a sudden we're getting river water into our drinking water lines, right? So, and it's not safe to drink. So again, a lot of it comes back to funding and then connecting that funding with the people who really need it and what barriers can we remove to actually get them the funding they need.
Yeah, and in a related way, I'm imagining that a core challenge in the work you do at Providence involves walking this tightrope of supporting economic drivers while also reducing environmental impacts and achieving compliance at the federal, state, and local levels while also helping clients achieve their goals.
Right.
So what's it like helping an entire organization and its clients maintain that balance while keeping an eye toward major long-term impacts and goals like economic growth and climate mitigation? So it seems like both and thinking may be a big part of it.
It's definitely a lot of both and thinking. A lot of what I do in my day-to-day job is definitely industrial related. So I help industries deal with their wastewater and water treatment challenges, in addition to public water and wastewater treatment challenges. So it's definitely a lot of recognizing, you know, how we as consumers, our behaviors. So working for plastics plants or oil and gas plants, you know, I filled up my car this morning, so I still need gas to be able to get me back and forth into work or to conferences that we fly to. And, you know, my car has got a lot of steel parts in it that protect me if I get broadsided. That requires a lot of water to make those things in the U.S. and has wastewater associated with it. And then it has a lot of plastics on it that also keep my car in one piece as I drive down the road. So it's that balance between understanding a lot of our consumer behaviors. And unfortunately, the plastics, the single-use plastics in COVID have definitely not necessarily skyrocketed, but have gone way up as we try to limit how many hands maybe touch a certain piece of plastic. But yeah, so it's balancing that. But I live here, right? So I want to still be able to walk barefoot on the beach. I want to be able to eat the seafood that lives in the Gulf of Mexico, where most of these larger facilities discharge their wastewater into. So it's that balance with working with them, understanding, and in many of, especially nowadays with the large global companies that are located in the US, they have very broad global ESG goals and water reduction goals. And they understand that water management is a very large part of their air emissions, their greenhouse gas emissions. So they are absolutely trying to do what they can to make sure that they're being responsible stewards of the water they pull in, you know, from whatever water body, and then ensuring that they comply with all environmental requirements before they put it back out. Just like our water and sewer plants, our wastewater treatment plants do, they have to, you know, comply with very similar, if not the same, regulations to EPA and the state regulatory agencies when they use and then put water back in, treated water back into the environment.
Yeah, and talking about ESG, you know, it reminds me, we cited in A Future So Bright the opportunity for AI to help maximize clean water availability, as, you know, in relation to UN SDG Goal 6, the clean water and sanitation. And of course, technology is wrapped up in all of these efforts to balance economic growth and human and environmental health. So in general, there's a lot of fear right now about technology and particularly AI, but I'm curious how technological innovation factors into supporting the work you do and the ways in which new tech is being integrated into the journey toward long-term sustainability in the sectors you work in.
Yeah. So, I mean, obviously this is an industry that has a significant workforce shortage, not unlike a lot of the medical fields. The water sector is facing our silver tsunami of people who we have been saved for many years. A lot of them haven't retired yet, but we're facing a lot of people leaving the workforce. So we know that technology is going to have to be a part of this. We're going to have to use AI and innovative and different thinking in order to do our jobs with less people available to do it. You know, we are absolutely working towards enhancing our communications so people do know we exist, so that they realize that this is a job opportunity coming out of high school or college, because we need both college educated and, you know, trade school type people to, you know, to run the water sector. It is a great job, again, just totally resilient to economic conditions. Okay, I'm trying to think back to what your question, the second part of your question was, but you know, so we have the sector, we're trying to make sure that we balance the people portion of it, understanding the ESG, the impact that we have, you know, when you see things that say, you know, it took X gallons of water to make this product, well, that's a different story if it was made in California or Arizona versus if it was made in Louisiana, right? Because we do have a lot of water. So the stresses on that particular plant are different depending upon, you know, where it was made within on the globe. So, you know, the ESG definitely, I am seeing facilities in Louisiana take that step and say, hey, can you help us maybe do some auditing of ourselves to where we can see kind of where we stand as far as our water goals from a global perspective and tie that back into our local impacts on the water. So I'm not sure if that answered the whole of your question, but I forgot the second part.
No, you touched on it. It was the technological innovation, yeah, and you did get there. I'm wondering, so, but then from what I've read, it seems like it's important to you that the industries you work in are communicating with consumers and customers about the work mm-hmm. you're doing by meeting them where they are, instead of throwing Absolutely. A bunch of tech lingo at them and hoping it's going to resonate. Can you speak to why it's so important to increase the visibility of your sector through communication?
Yeah, we had a great convening last year of water leaders, not just in water and wastewater from a municipal perspective or utility perspective, but across industries. And one of the things, like, you know, the public typically doesn't understand is how much water is needed to run data centers, to run the internet, right? Like, all we do every day requires so much water just to cool, you know, the cool systems within data centers. And then that water gets, you know, they need water. And we have to locate these things where people are. So they have to be located in Arizona. They have to be located in water scarce places. So what's the best use? How can we give them the water? Maybe we give them treated effluent to use as makeup water because they're not using it to drink, right? So it's how can we connect the people who need water with water that's intended for their use? That may not necessarily be drinkable water, and then connect them on the back end. You know, you want to talk about technology. One of the conversations we continue to have is definitely the cooling waters, right? Because there's a lot of it, millions and millions of gallons a day. And in order for cooling systems to work, unfortunately, we have to put chemicals to keep, you know, algae and other things from growing in that lovely warm water as it cools, so it doesn't completely clog up all of our AC systems and cooling systems, right? So, but you're also evaporating a lot of water. So maybe you use something that has a little chlorine in it to keep the algae down. Well, then chlorides just start to build up in that system. But then you can't necessarily put that water back into a local water body because now it's kind of salt water, right? So it's trying to figure
out. Sorry. Will someone please?
What's happening?
Lower warehouse door.
I can't turn my announcement speaker off on my phone. I apologize for that.
Oh, this is a great moment to have captured. It's great.
Yes, yes. The lab is here to pick up samples. So again, it's you know, that innovation, that technology, who are out there doing amazing, cool things to innovate what we can do with some of these high mineral waters, that it's not just, you know, somebody who makes plastics or oil and gas or steel manufacturing or chemical plants. You know, it's the internet that needs a lot of water. It's the power, you know, you turn your light switch on every day. That requires so much water to generate power. So what are we doing collectively in the water space to say, hey, look, we all have similar problems. What can we do to innovate together, more so than just in our own little groups, to figure out some of the common solutions to some of these challenges. So,
and that sounds like a public education challenge as much as anything.
Yes.
And I know in general, when industries struggle to communicate with consumers about their mission, it can lead to misconceptions that hamper that mission. So in the work mm-hmm. that you do, in what other kinds of misconceptions have you observed non-experts holding about the journey to a life free of water challenges?
Yeah, I mean, again, just acknowledge that we exist is like baby step number one, right? That everything you do, everything we own, our phone, the pencil, my paper sitting in front of me, you know, my water bottle, everything required probably a lot of water to make it. The light, to turn on the light switch, requires so much water just to get that power made into you. So, or in for the most part, the public typically doesn't even know where their drinking water comes from, or much less when they flush the toilet, where it goes to get treated. How is it treated? Where does it go after it's treated? And same with stormwater, right? We do have a lot of flooding that occurs down here in South Louisiana. And we tend to only communicate with the public when they're flooding, right? And yes, we go out, we empathize with them in that moment. But the other 360 days a year, how are we educating them to say, hey, look, our neighborhoods are built for a 24-hour, 25-year storm event. We got the 50-year storm event, and none of us can afford to live in neighborhoods that are built for a 100-year storm event, right? Like, systems are built for certain things. And as the climate is changing and we're seeing the storm events happen more and more frequently, you know, it's understanding, okay, what storm was my house or my neighborhood designed for, right? Older homes were built to older standards and not necessarily today's standards. So, you know, it's that education and that outreach. Definitely, you know, we have a lot of events around like outreach to school age children and how we can educate them on water and teach them where their water comes from and the water cycle. And then we do the same with high school students. But, you know, we've been doing that for a very long time. And we just haven't, we feel like we haven't moved the needle. So we are definitely now in the process of coming together with other water sector industry or nonprofits in industries to say, okay, what can we collectively do, come together collectively do to help move that needle a little bit more than we've kind of on our own accomplished over the last, you know, couple decades. You know, how do we now communicate and move that needle? Rather than telling people at the airport, you just saved 50 bottles from the landfill, let's have a picture of Susan who cleaned the water and say, hey, look, this is Susan. She took the water from this river, cleaned it, and brought it to you in this water fountain. And by the way, you saved 50 water bottles from going to the landfill, right? So like, it's taking that next step in communication and meet, like you said, meeting people where they are, and get, you know, getting children to convince their parents, you know, to turn off the water when they're brushing their teeth or doing other things. So continuing with what we've been doing, but we do recognize and we are working with other organizations to even take it up another notch now.
Yeah, because I do think most people or many people don't have to give a second thought to how we'll access safe water and sanitation. And it's easy to miss out on both the value of water and the impact that our water usage has. So like, just turn the tap on and water comes out. We don't put thought into the chain of events that occurs in order for that to happen. And it's different from, you know, going to the grocery store and seeing where my avocados were grown or, you know, if my cotton t-shirt was ethically sourced or whatever.
Right.
So it sounds like what you're talking about is, you know, connecting that story in the supply chain, mm-hmm. but also, you know, you've touched on a little bit on the labor issues that are mm-hmm. part of this whole story. So are there ways that your sector can help people recognize above and beyond what you said, recognize the value of water and the ways that our water footprint has, you know, bigger environmental impact?
Yeah. I mean, we talked about that at a workshop I was at last week, right? Like, how do we effectuate, you know, lofty goals? How do we effectuate consumer behavior change? Right. Yeah. We can do that tomorrow. Right. But but if you give me a choice, right? Like, you know, we use example, you're scrolling online, and I have a choice. To buy something that has Gen X chemicals in it or buy something that doesn't, I think a lot of us would choose to spend the extra money to not. But as consumers, we're typically not given that choice to purchase something that may have been made. You know, we can go seek it out individually, but it's not, you know, we kind of look at it from the PFAS perspective, if you're familiar with that, the Gen X chemicals, just that's one class of them. You know, you have companies, REI and Patagonia in particular, who are saying, hey, look, we're not going to sell things with PFAS in them anymore. And that's great for those of us who purchase products at those two suppliers. But, you know, until larger chain stores get on board and say, hey, look, you know, we're not going to sell things that contain PFAS because we know they're not good for humans in the environment, you know, people are going to continue to make the choices that are available to them at the stores that they frequent. We had the same conversation about brown paper towels, right? Craft paper that is so much easier to make. It's cheaper to make. It's better for the environment, but yet it costs more when I want the brown ones versus the white ones, right? Like, do we just quit making white paper towels? Is it that necessary for the world to wipe your hand on a white napkin versus a brown napkin, right? So, like, are we going to, how can we effectuate those behavior changes? And some of them may need to be, you know, industry just deciding that we want to do the best thing for the environment. So we're going to make these changes in the chains, kind of the chain stores having the say, we want to do what's best. And our stockholders and our, you know, our boards are demanding that we do what's best for the environment as well. And so we're going to make these changes within our systems.
Yeah. So, yeah. Last question I have for you is that it's obvious from your engagement online on X and LinkedIn that community building, mentorship, and raising up new leaders in your sector is really important to you. And so I just wonder, how do you like to communicate with the next generation of environmentalists and water quality professionals about where the hope is in the work that you do, and especially in the context of climate change?
Yeah, it gets me so excited, right? So I've done a little bit of work like in the Black Belt of Alabama with some of the sanitary issues they've had there. I love to have my mind blown by the ideas they come up with, because I've been doing this so long. I think of we can only treat wastewater this way, or this is the standard way to do it. But to go and experience, I feel like I'm learning more than they are, right? Like, how can we do this? Can we treat wastewater with electricity? I'm like, you can. Let's go dig into it more, right? Like, how can we do these awesome and crazy things that, because those of us who have been in the industry for so long are kind of ingrained to how we've done it. So I definitely get more energy out of spending time with the young professionals myself. But no, I mean, we recognize that we have to bring young leaders up into this industry. You know, what if my goals in life is to become irrelevant, right? Like, I want to teach people everything I know so that one day I come to work and say like, hey, look, I've taught enough people to where I don't have to do this anymore. And to pass on that knowledge to mentor people. And nowadays with technology, it is so easy to mentor people from all around the world. And if you ask anybody, will you be my mentor? 99% of the time, they're going to say, absolutely. What can I do to help? But there's a lot of challenges in the world today, right? And so a lot of the mentoring that I do now is definitely around more social, mental health. You know, hey, look, how would you deal with this? What are you seeing? I also think it's especially important for women in this field, because I think we're 17 to 15% of the industry. So a very small percentage of us, to show other young women, hey, look, you know, there's going to be struggles. You're going to have bosses who don't get it, but you can stay with it. You can be successful. And here are some examples of how you can get there. And you can have other mentors in the field who may not be within your company, within the organization that you work, but we're there for you. So that's been really important to me. And also to make sure that we have mentors, and I do quite a few STEM events in and around the area, and making sure when I'm asked to go speak, that I'm the best person, you know, to go speak at that school. Hey, look, I know that school. I don't look like most of the female students there. Let me hook you up with one of my friends who's in the field, who is a Black American, and I'll get her. Would you rather she come? Because they can't see themselves in me, right? So again, it's making sure, you know, if you can see it, you can be it. And that's important for me as well, is to make sure we're bringing people up and we're given the opportunity to see that, hey, look, there are people that look like me, especially female, out in the STEM fields doing great work. Just because I don't see them in my organization, don't get distressed. They're out there, and there's other females that are more than willing to mentor and help you out.
We also spoke with Charles Greeley, or Chuck, as he is better known. Chuck is the assistant division leader of DUDEX Engineering Group and the current president of the California Water Environment Association. You started your water journey as a civil engineering student, right, at the University of Washington?
Yeah, I've had an interesting background. I've changed career path a number of times. I started out at University of Washington. Yep. So third generation proud Husky. My dad was a mechanical engineering graduate there, worked for the Navy for a long time. And I found that I didn't like moving structures. I liked things that stayed in place. And so civil kind of gravitated, or so that's where I gravitated to in my career, was the civil engineering side instead of mechanical engineering.
How did you end up going from civil engineering and ending up a passionate advocate for a sustainable water future in California.
Yeah, well, water engineering is a huge component of civil engineering. Civil covers a really broad base of infrastructure, from transportation infrastructure to structural design, potable water, pipelines, pump stations, wastewater treatment. So it's a really broad spectrum of skills in the civil engineering arena. You know, I started out doing a lot of structural engineering work in Seattle. You know, post-graduation, worked up there for about 5 or 6 years. Met my wonderful wife, and we decided to move to Southern California for a job opportunity for her. And I just didn't see a lot of project opportunities in the structural realm, and stumbled upon Dudek, who's my current employer. I've been with them ever since, and started doing a little bit of site development work. The housing market tanked, kind of had to recreate my career again. And through that kind of housing market, the development side, I discovered kind of the world of water engineering. And really found that that was an area that I found a passion and a commitment by the people in that profession that I just gravitated towards. And so the loss of kind of that development market opened up an opportunity to really recreate myself. So started to look at opportunities in water, covering storm water and surface water, you know, potable water, drinking water, wastewater treatment. And through that, discovered, okay, that's where my passion is. That's where I want to pursue the rest of my career, and was able to stumble into the California Water Environment Association. The local chapter here where I live in the Coachella Valley is called the Colorado River Basin Section. And we were doing a project for the city of Coachella. A gentleman there said, hey, why don't you come out to one of our meetings? I'll introduce you around. And it's really just kind of blossomed and taken off from there. So through that, that guy kind of putting his arm around me and saying, hey, why don't you come to a meeting and meet some folks? You're new to the area. It's blossomed into the role I have at CWA now.
Which is president.
President.
Right?
Yep.
And I love the tagline for this year's conference, a sustainable water future against all odds. And I feel like it's important to establish the context surrounding why the odds are against us when it comes to a sustainable water future. Like, most people know climate change is the big boogeyman, but how does climate change make the odds feel kind of unbeatable when it comes to water specifically?
Sure. I mean, climate change is a huge component of that, obviously. We as a society rely on a number of different water supply areas for domestic use. So it's both surface water as well as groundwater. And really this climate change impact is having, you know, negative or deleterious effects on both of those sources. So if we think in the context of the broader water cycle, right? So we get our rainfall, it goes into mountains as, you know, runoff where we can capture and use that, or snow, which is, you know, snow, the snowpack in California is the largest single reservoir in the state of California. And as we go through these cycles of dry and wet periods, you know, maybe we have, like right now, California has, I think, about 104% of its annual snowpack, but they're starting to predict some warmer, wet weather events. So rather than having that slow melt of the snowpack where we get the measured runoff that we can actually utilize, capture, or recharge naturally in our groundwater aquifers, you get those big, wet, warm storm events, and that snow melts at a much more rapid pace. So the cyclic nature of our water cycle is thrown off. We've got, you know, overuse of groundwater resources where we're pumping more than we're able to recharge. So, you know, we're really in this mode that we're not really appropriately or adequately using our water resources. So it's, you know, that the climate change component, we've got pollutants and emerging pollutants. You know, we think of these forever chemicals that we hear in the news, or the PFASs, you know, that go into fire retardant foam, some of the clothes we wear, you know, our waterproof jackets. You know, we're learning more and more about these chemicals that we've used on an industrial basis that were intended to improve our lives, but are having unintended consequences within our water realm. So climate change, new pollutants, you know, evolving regulations, where we talk about, you know, the Clean Water Act of 1972, that really was a huge driver of, you know, innovation within the clean water realm and wastewater treatment. Regulations have been evolving ever since then, but we've never had that kind of generational shift or that generational investment in money that would go towards that clean water or renovating a lot of these wastewater treatment plants that were built based on Clean Water Act funding in the 70s. Those facilities are now 50 years or older, and in many cases are starting to fall apart, and we haven't had that huge investment of capital resources to reinvigorate or improve upon those facilities. So climate change, regulations, pollutants, a lack of funding, and aging infrastructure is a huge one as well.
And it also seems important for people to understand what life will be like for humans if we don't achieve a sustainable water future, so as much as we hate to think about that. But paint a picture for us. What kind of life are humans looking at living if we don't work hard to achieve our water goals right now, or don't get that investment, as you're talking about, into that sort of once in a lifetime generational set of resources?
Sure. I mean, we go on the Wayback Machine, and I'm a history buff, so it's always fun to do that for me. But, and this isn't to say we'll go back there, but let's think about the Dark Ages and, you know, where we saw huge health issues, associated with, in many cases, with a lack of clean water, right? And so in my mind, the idea that we're able to maintain a healthy water environment and provide clean drinking water resources to society is probably humankind's greatest invention. So, you know, that is probably, in my mind, again, singularly the item I can point to and say, this has been what's allowed humankind to really blossom, was clean water. Obviously, we'll not get there, but I think the idea that without that investment, without looking at, opportunities to improve our existing facilities, looking at alternative water sources, utilizing the water at hand, going through the advanced treatment opportunities that we have to really recycle and use direct potable reuse as an asset for us. We are talking about a lack of adequate drinking water sources for some parts of our society, and in many cases, the most vulnerable.
I think it's a really powerful argument that clean water is the most important invention. I wonder why we don't say the best thing since clean water instead of the best thing since sliced bread.
I love it. If we could get that out there, you win the day in the water world, that's for sure.
You were talking about at CWA, the Colorado River Basin section, and I'm always thinking at KO Insights in my work, I'm always thinking about how the places we care about shape our ideas about how to build a brighter future for everyone. I wonder if you could talk about how working closely within that region, which I understand is especially vulnerable to climate change-induced Sure. water loss, as you've described, has shaped your ideas about how to build a brighter water future more broadly.
Yeah, I mean, my connection with water goes back to where I grew up. I grew up in the Pacific Northwest on the Puget Sound. And so, boating and fishing, backpacking in those mountains and being able to go and pull a little bit of water, pump a little bit of water into a poly bottle and drink it while we're backpacking. And that connection has been with me since I, was a littlest kid, but in many cases kind of taken for granted. You don't start to appreciate it until you start to understand what goes into it and just how much of an impact clean water has on our society. Being down in the Coachella Valley, the connection with water is clear. We're in a desert environment, but if you visit our beautiful community, you see a heck of a lot of green. And so, you understand that connection and that viability, what water means to the community. If we didn't have a really strong, sustainable groundwater resource that was really well managed by our local water agencies and water districts, we'd be in a world of hurt. We wouldn't have the vital community that we have. We wouldn't have the tourism and the community. And you see some of that in some of our more rural communities. You see areas in the Eastern Coachella Valley, many migrant farmers or disadvantaged community groups that don't have access to that clean water. And that's really easy for most of the community to ignore because, it's not areas that they travel on a daily basis. But as we get out and we see that, and we see the impact that that has, people having to truck in their water, not have modern sanitation. They've got areas where their sewerage just goes into surface ponds. It's pretty striking. And I think a really important measure that both our local politicians, as well as those water agencies are really starting to address.
Talking about challenges there, some of the challenges you're listing off, I'm wondering about how getting into how technology has been a disruptive force sort of before and against in some ways these issues and for CWEA. I'm wondering what the water sector could look like going forward with new technologies playing an active role in the push for a sustainable water future. What does that look like to you?
Yeah, I think we're really at the precipice of a real sea change in the clean water realm and what technology can do for us. Obviously, technology has evolved from the very early beginnings of wastewater treatment into, some really high level treatment techniques and methods that we use today that allow us to have the indirect or the direct potable reuse. Direct potable reuse is where we take it and we clean that wastewater to such a high quality that we can put it right back into that drinking water stream. And so people in the clean water industry are always looking for technological advancements that allow us to do our job better. But I think the advent of AI is a unique one for us, in that those future water workers, I think, are not going to be focused simply on the mechanical operations and testing of that water. You know, we're going to have to be aware of automation in our system and how AI can help us do our job better. Can it be more predictive and look at trends and opportunities where, you know, we can do better, we can optimize, we can improve our processes and have a water workforce that is really on the front edge of that and adapting that into our day-to-day job, because it does provide improved outcomes really for the water resources.
You talked a little bit about AI and the future water workers. It seems like every industry is grappling with workforce growing pains as they seek to meet sustainability goals in tandem with ongoing growth and development. So where are the pain points for the water sector workforce when it comes to sustaining a resilient, dedicated profession that's ready for the future?
Yeah, we're in the same mode. You know, we've been talking about kind of this silver tsunami, it felt like, for many, many years. And for a variety of reasons that kept getting delayed. I think the most recent one was, you know, some economic issues around COVID and the pandemic. And now that we've pretty well come out of that, we're starting to see an uptick in the economy. We're starting to see that wave, and it's really impacting the clients we work with, our water agency, and those employers, because there's so much institutional knowledge. Folks who've worked there in some cases for many decades that are going off to enjoy a well-earned retirement, but taking that understanding of how their systems operate with them. And we're not seeing a ton of ability to backfill those positions. The water workforce is one that once you get into it and you understand the impacts that you have a burning passion and you are dedicated to that industry. But I think we do a pretty poor job of selling ourselves out there and getting folks interested in a career path in water. Many of the folks I work with, I mean, myself included, didn't go immediately into water, right? I started out in structural engineering and through happenstance and circumstance, found my way into the water realm and found my passion. How do we do a better job of getting out there and sharing, you know, what a wonderful opportunity this is to start a career in water and not have to find your way in a different pathway?
Yeah, I wonder if there's a way in which new technology can be leveraged to lessen the blow that you're talking about, that labor shortage, or even to attract and train new talent. Is that something that CWA or that you're thinking about specifically?
Yeah, I think it's important that we think about it. You know, we go through a strategic planning cycle about every 3 to 4 years, which is, you know, great in the short term. I think that that's really important for us as an association and for our members to be looking forward. But I think it's time we start looking a little bit further down the road and those types of things of how we're recruiting, how we're getting a more diverse workforce is important. And that diversity comes in many different shapes and styles. And certainly the idea of a younger generation that is growing up with some of these new technologies and more adept at them is going to be a selling point for them. It's not a case of, hey, you've got to put aside your computer skills and your knowledge there to focus on, you know, mechanical asset maintenance, for instance, or laboratory testing. There's an opportunity to integrate that and be on the cutting edge, integrating, you know, those new skill sets into the water workforce.
Yeah. And to be able to not make the trade-off between climate advocacy and technology. I know when it comes to carrying that sustainability mission forward, education and mentorship are crucial. You know, you talked about the silver tsunami and making sure we have that continuity, because we need that next generation to step up and be climate advocates, but also have that institutional knowledge. So what has that process looked like for CWA? Where do you find the most meaningful moments of education and mentorship happening in the journey toward a sustainable water future?
Yeah, we've got a newly engaged mentorship program that we started last year, which has been, I think, fantastic, a really strong success for us. That's going to start to grow and blossom, and we'll have more folks involved in that formal mentorship program. I think this comes down to, you know, a member by member connection with our community and, you know, spreading the gospel of clean water, as I like to say. My kids are in high school. Every opportunity I have to go and visit with a classroom full of, you know, these future water workforce members, potential future water workforce members, I take. You know, I'd love to go in and talk about water resources in the Coachella Valley, because so many of them do take it for granted and don't understand, you know, what it means to be able to get up in the morning and turn the faucet on and have a clean drink of water. They don't recognize or appreciate that, you know, I don't have to necessarily go through the traditional, you know, college education path. There's alternatives out there that can lead to a really meaningful career for me that's, you know, also financially successful, right? Many of our members, you know, have very comfortable lives, and you can do quite well without an advanced degree in the water world. And people just don't have an appreciation and understanding for that. So I think we as an industry individually have to do a much better job of selling ourselves. You know, it's way too easy for us to just do our job behind the scenes. And it's important that we recognize the value we bring and the opportunity and really start to advertise that in any way that we can.
It's clear that you really value CWA and CWA members and the ways that they advance the association's mission. So I wonder, could you talk a little more about the most valuable ways that CWA members advocate for the association, maybe your dreams for future action from CWEA members?
Yeah, advocacy is certainly part of our core mission at CWEA, you know, outside of just our certification and networking and educational opportunities. But we've got to be careful, right? We're about a 10,000 member association, and we're all going to have a different vision for what advocacy means. And so I think the idea of advocacy really focuses around what's best for our members, and that future workforce is a huge component of that. So where we've seen some of the most powerful advocacy, I think, is partnering with some other clean water associations out there. We've got Cal Nevada AWWA, which is the American Water Works Association. We partnered with them on our Advanced Water Treatment Operator Certification Program. So those are the folks that we've now certified to lead these facilities that are cleaning water to that direct potable reuse level. So partnering with them, you know, getting that program out there, working with the state and other regulators to understand the value we have is certainly huge at the higher level. But then working forward, you know, we've got a student and young professional association or group within CWEA that has a chance to connect with college students and younger individuals to let them know about opportunities in the wastewater realm. Start to network with peers and members who've got, you know, some longevity in their career. So a less formal mentoring component within that student and young professional association. And I think that is one where we're starting to see more and more people get involved in that committee with us. And I think something that we've got to look at leveraging in the future of how do we get them more involved? How do we take advantage of the connections they have, you know, with this younger generation?
Getting involved in connection sounds like a great segue to the conference that's coming up very quickly. Seems like you get pretty pumped for the CWA annual conference. What do members come to the CWA conference hoping to experience? And what do you hope participants walk away with and carry forward when the conference comes to an end?
Yeah, I mean, it's such a wonderful opportunity, you know, not only for education, but the networking side. You know, we've got over 80 technical programs where folks can attend and learn about some of the most recent and leading edge technology and solutions that are being implemented, you know, at wastewater treatment plants and collection systems throughout the state of California. We've got some amazing technical tours, right? So how can we bring people together, connect them, again, that connectivity component, but also have them step out thinking, hey, I learned something today that I'm going to have an opportunity to take back to my facility or the folks I work with who weren't lucky enough to be able to attend and really talk about how do we maybe implement some of these solutions into our day-to-day activities.
And really popularize the expression, best thing since clean water.
I love it. Yep.
We're going to work on it. I lied. I'll have one last question, which is, if you succeed in making yourself irrelevant, will we find you permanently walking barefoot on the beach?
Yeah, different beaches, right? Like, okay. I like to travel. So I want to go walk barefoot on your beach somewhere, a beach I've never been to.
A lot of beaches in New York City. Come on up. I don't know that you want to walk barefoot on them, but
we're working on it. Great organization in New York. I was up there last year.
Oh, excellent.
Water work.
One of the unique things about the presidency for CWEA is that we do have an opportunity to really drive the thematic element of the annual conference. So this was definitely a fun one to put together and really excited. I think it speaks to everything that we've talked about here, right? That we've got some really significant challenges ahead of us, but I've got every confidence, you know, having been involved here, knowing the people, knowing the passion that we bring, that this really is a mission possible. And you know, there's nothing out there in terms of those challenges that we face that has me losing sleep, because I know the people behind the scenes that are working to address them.
And now you know those people a little bit better too. Thanks for joining us. Thank you for listening to The Tech Humanist Show. This episode was produced with help from our extended team, including research by Ashley Robinson and Aaron Daugherty at Interabang. You can find more information about the show's guests and links to their projects at thetechhumanist.com, where you can also find more episodes, or you can subscribe at iTunes or wherever you get your podcasts. Special thanks to all of our guests for lending their voices and ideas to help make the future a brighter place. I'm Kate O'Neill, and you've been listening to The Tech Humanist Show from KO Insight.